All right, we're ready for chapters 21 to 24 of Leviticus. That's where we are. We're quickly coming to an end of this book, chapters 25 to 27. Next time is what we'll be covering and finish the book and then ready for the book of Numbers. This is one of the outlines that we're following, and we are in this section here of 21 to 24. We'll deal with rules for priests, then the feast, and then taking care of the lamp and the showbread, and then there's the sin of blasphemy in chapter 24. So miscellaneous things here in these chapters. As per Wiersbe, we're in the holy priesthood and the holy days. We've dealt with the holy nation. I like his outline perhaps maybe a little better. Let's review where we've been, and then we'll get underway with chapter 21. Chapter 1, burnt offerings. Chapter 2, grain offerings. Remember, chapters 1 through 7 primarily deals with offerings, so we ought to get close just saying some offering there. So we have in chapter 3, peace. And then chapter 4 is sin offering. Chapter 5, trespass offering and restitution. Restitution goes into or bleeds into chapter 6. And then we have other offerings. Then we have in chapter 7, the offerings and the eating of blood. That completes one section of the book, the offerings. Chapter 8 now, consecration of the priesthood. And so here we have Aaron and his sons being inaugurated into the office. And then in chapter 9, they start the work of priesthood. They begin the work of priesthood. Chapter 10, a notable example, Nadab and Abihu. Chapter 11, clean and unclean animals. Chapter 12, purification of a woman after childbirth. Chapter 13, leprosy. And chapter 14 bleeds over from that, dealing with cleansing of the leper. Chapter 15, bodily discharges. Chapter 16, a notable chapter you want to remember, Day of Atonement. You'll come to that time and again. We'll flag that chapter a little bit later in our study tonight. Chapter 17, yeah, sacrifice at the tabernacle and sanctity of blood. Very good. Chapter 18 dealt with sexual laws. Chapter 19, various laws dealing primarily with relationships. And then we ended in chapter 20 with that require capital punishment or death. All right, very good. Let's look at chapters 21 to 24. Let's go to question number one for tonight. Which I'm not sure I've got. Anyway, it should be chapter, yeah, here we go. Question one is Leviticus 21 is about what? You can look on the screen. Yeah, priest, regulations for the priest and for the high priest. And so here's some various regulations with reference to that. We'll get underway with that in a moment. Chapter 22. Yeah, has to do with the food that the priest would eat and acceptable sacrifices. And we'll talk about the details of that in a moment. Chapter 23, various feasts and when they occur. There's some early feast and late feast. We'll categorize them accordingly on the calendar. Chapter 24, taking care of the... yeah. Very good. Tabernacle furnishings such as the table, the showbread, and the oil, etc., as Stephen just mentioned. And then there is an example of blasphemy, a notable example here, and the untimeliness of that perhaps is emphasized. Some make a point about that. We'll see if that fits in just a few moments. All right, let's get underway with chapter 21. Chapter 21 deals with the regulations for the priest and for the high priest. So first of all, we have the regulations for the priest, then verses 1 to 9, 10 to 15, the regulations for the high priest, and then no priest is to have any defect. And we see that in chapter 21. Now, what I want us to see in chapter 21 is the emphasis seems to be on holiness. And so I'm not going to get bogged down. We'll deal with the regulations. We're going to subdivide these sections. Here's what the regulations were for the priest. Here's what the regulations were for the high priest. Here are the defects that cannot be, if you have this defect, you cannot be a priest. We'll get to all of that. But I want us to get the overall picture, and hopefully you'll be watching for some practical things. There are a number of things we can put in that last question. But one of the things I want us to see is the emphasis here seems to be on holiness in regards to those who approach God. And unless they were holy, they could not approach God as a priest. Well, in the New Testament, we're all a priest. And so that means, in application, that we need to learn the principle. We need to be holy in order to approach God. And you're not going to be able to approach God. Not going to be able to have your sacrifice be acceptable to God unless we're holy. Does that make sense? Very practical thing, I think, to learn. All right, let's look at the first 9 verses here. And so let's go to question number 2. What are some of the regulations here with reference to those given to priests in verses 1 to 9? All right, had to do with death. All right, what else? We'll come back to that. He could not, couldn't shave their heads. And that seems to be in connection with verses 1 to 4. Then what else did we see? No cuttings in the flesh. And they were not to marry harlot or defiled woman or divorced woman. And if his daughter becomes a harlot, she was to be put to death because she would profane him. Well, we got some ground to cover. Let's see what we have here. All right, let's start with verses 1 to 4. This is, again, I want us to, if we could paint a background, just look in the background of the picture we're painting, and the emphasis is on the priest being holy. And with that in mind, he says, verses 1 to 4, that he should not be defiled by any dead among his people. So he was not to touch the dead because he's trying to maintain purity. Now there are exceptions to that, and that is a close or near kin, such as his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, or his brother, or if it be a virgin sister, meaning she didn't have a husband, may defile himself. He may touch the dead or be in contact with the dead. Now, it's interesting his wife is not mentioned here, though some scholars suggest that's probably assumed since the other near kin are exceptions, she would be too. But I'll leave that for you to decide for yourself. I don't have any basis on which to argue that, other than the other close kin. And otherwise, he's not to defile himself, being a chief man among his people to profane himself. So in other words, the emphasis, he's to maintain his purity, he's approaching God, is the idea. Then at verse 5, I take verse 5 to be signs of mourning. Maybe it was to be carried further that he was not to have any kind of markings at all on his body. You say that's what it is, then have at that, that's fine. But these seem to be connected with verses 1 to 4 with the idea of mourning. We see more about mourning in chapter 21 beginning at verse 10. But one of the ways in which one would mourn is they would, so that they could show that they were mourning, was have a bald spot on their head or shave the corners of their beard. In other words, cut part of their beard off and someone's, it's like putting yourself in sackcloth and ashes so that there is a symbol and someone sees that indeed you are mourning. It's a symbol or a sign of mourning. And cutting their flesh. None of that was to be done. So he doesn't carry about him a public sign of mourning. Doesn't mean he's not sad or doesn't mourn over the loss of his mother, his father, or his sister, or close near son or his daughter. But he doesn't come in contact with them, and he doesn't show the signs of mourning. Then what at verse 6 do we learn he's not to do? Yeah, they shall be holy to the Lord. Notice that emphasis. They shall be holy to the Lord and not profane the name of the Lord their God. for they offer the offerings of the Lord. Here's the reason they need to maintain their holiness, is they're making their offerings before God and the bread of their God. I take the idea of the bread of their God at verse 6 and at verse 8 to stand for simply the sacrifices that they bring before God. So they're the ones who are offering the bread of God. They're offering the sacrifices of God, and so they're to be holy. Now, you might flag verse 6 just for a moment. We're going to put a slide up in just a moment about reasons for being what we should be. But here's what we should be, or what the priest should be, and in parallel what we should be. Therefore, they shall be holy. And we're going to see several things in the context about that. Line that at verse 6. They shall be holy. All right, now at verse 9, he's not to marry a harlot or a defiled woman or a divorced woman. Well, Ezekiel 44 and in verse 22, when the priests are discussed, they can marry a widow of another priest. That's not mentioned here. So was that a latter revelation? Maybe. So that's not true at this point, but becomes true later? Maybe. I don't know how to argue that. I'm just saying that by Ezekiel 44, that not only was he not to marry these, but he could marry the widow of another priest. Does that make sense? So you might flag Ezekiel 44:22 along that line. Now then, let's get verses 8 and 9 to finish that. The daughter who is a harlot should be put to death. Here is a capital punishment. I want to say more about capital punishment in chapter 24 in a minute, as time permits. But what do you learn from verses 8 and 9? There's some practical things here. All right, has to do with respect to God. Let's talk about her playing the harlot. That expression is used with reference to one that we think of as a prostitute or as a harlot. Is that included? Yes. And so if she goes and sells her services to someone, she is a harlot. The Bible uses it in that sense. The Blackmores argue in their work on Leviticus, this excellent commentary, if you care to delve a little bit more, the Truth Commentary series, the Blackmores, they go a little further and point out that the same word is used not just with selling yourself, but any form of sexual immorality. So be it a premarital or extramarital relationship, that's also selling herself to be a harlot or becoming or playing the harlot. It's the idea of sexual promiscuity is the idea. So I think it's perhaps broader than that. So I don't know that it's limited to selling herself. But notice that she profanes her father in that. It didn't say she profanes herself. She does. But she profanes her father. How so? Yeah. Her profanity becomes his profanity. We're not talking about language. We're talking about becoming corrupt. Now, that doesn't mean that he bears her sin, but he bears part of the consequence of that. Let me give you an example. In Ezekiel 13 and in verse 19, in Ezekiel 22:36, the Lord is profaned by his children. Well, certainly when God's children sin, God doesn't become a sinner. He's profane. In other words, it's a reflection on God if his children are doing that. And so it's a reflection on her dad. He carries part of the shame. Her shame becomes his shame. And so that's part of the point. That reflects on his holiness. Not that he's not holy. She's the one that made the choice. It reflects on him. Now, what's to be done with her? Well, she shall be burned with fire. One commentator observed, and he may be right, that in light of Joshua 7:25, that when Achan sinned, they stoned him and then burned him with fire, that we may assume, and it is an assumption, that they probably stoned her and then burned her with fire. But the stoning is not mentioned. So that's just an assumption based on Joshua 7:25. All right, questions on verses 1 to 9. We took a little longer than I meant. Let's go to 10 to 15 now. Let's talk about the regulations for the high priest. This seems to have reference to the same things we just noticed earlier, that he's not to uncover his head or tear his clothes. That seems to be signs of mourning. And so just as the high priest has, just as the priest has the obligation when there is this death or whatever it may be in the family, he's not to show signs of mourning. Well, the high priest is not to tear his clothes or to shave his head, according to verse 10. Then verse 11 and 12 says he's not to do what? He's not to go near dead body. He becomes unclean. So let's quickly get 13 to 15. He's to marry a virgin, take a woman in her virginity, and a widow or a divorced woman or a defiled woman or a harlot, they may not marry. The high priest could not do that, but as I mentioned a moment ago, in light of Ezekiel 44, I assume later some provision was made for the priest to marry a widow. But in this case, not so. Nor shall he profane his posterity, I'm reading from the New King James, or his seed among the people, for I, the Lord, sanctify him. Now, it's interesting that at verse 9, the children could profane the parents. Here, it's possible for the parents to profane the children. In other words, in this context, he marries a divorced woman, he marries this defiled woman, or he takes someone other than a virgin for his wife, then his children are profaned because the marriage was not what God wanted. And so now the children are profaned in the sense the shame that the parents have now bleeds off to the children, just like what the children have in their shame can bleed back to the parents. Does that make sense? Close family relationships have impact on all the others. All right, now let's finish the chapter, and hopefully you're finding some practical things to write down in answer to question number 9. We have several. No priest is to have any defect. So he lists a number of those. And I want to get more to the point of that, but we'll list some of them. You speak to Aaron, and for the succeeding generations that there should not be any defect. I'm reading verse 17, may approach to offer the bread of his God. There's that phrase again, the bread of his God. No one with any defect. And so in light of what we just saw in verses 1 to 15, seems to be focusing on God wants the purity. God wants holiness. Not saying one who has a defect couldn't be a holy person. Not saying one who touched the dead couldn't also become holy. It's just saying that God has regulations and is looking for purity. We'll say more about purity in a moment. What are some of the defects? If he was, verse 18, blind, lame, a marred face, one translation will say a flat nose, or a limb too long, or a part of the body that's superfluous, meaning some have suggested maybe an extra finger. There are people who have six fingers on a hand or six toes. That's a defect. That wouldn't be proper. That's not, what's the word, politically correct to talk about defects. God did, and so I'm going to go with him. If he has a broken foot, if he's hunchback, if he has an itch of the skin, a defect of the eye, or if he were a eunuch. Any one of those things, he's not qualified to be high priest. So he may be of a son of Aaron, of a descendant of Aaron, but coming along, and here is one of the sons that happens to be a hunchback or a dwarf or a broken foot or broken hand, he was not to be priest. God wanted wholeness and completeness in the priesthood. Does that make sense? All right. Now, that does not keep him, though, from verse 22. taking any of the bread. He's still a priest, or he's still a Levite. He's still of the children of God. He could eat of the bread of the family of the priesthood. That's the point I'm trying to make. But he shall not go near the veil because of his defect, lest he profane my sanctuary, for I, the Lord, sanctify them. And so Moses told that to Aaron and all the children of Israel. All right. Chapter 21, regulations for the priest and the high priest. Now, here's what I said we'd come back to. Chapter 21, verse 6. Here's reasons for being what we should be. Now, for the priest, they should be holy. But notice the reasons he gives. 11 times in these chapters, he said, I'm the Lord. Be holy, I'm the Lord. I'm the Lord. I'm the Lord. I'm the Lord. He must have wanted to emphasize it a lot because he mentions it 11 times in our study tonight. You need to be holy, for I'm the Lord. You'd think they'd get it the first time, but no, he wanted to mention it 11 times. And so I need to be holy. Why do I need to be holy? Because he's the Lord. He's the ruler. I need to be pure. All right, second reason. Not only is he the Lord, chapter 21, verse 8, he says, I am holy. You need to be holy because I'm holy. You're my servant. You're my child. I'm holy. You need to be holy. Gave a third reason. Because I'm the one who sanctifies. We just saw that at verse 15. We'll see it again in chapter 22, verse 9. Does that make sense? Perhaps there's more reasons that he gave. I found those three. So, these chapters are motivational. You say, I want to do better. I want to be more pure. What reasons do I need to be? Because God's the Lord, because he's holy, and because he's the one that sanctifies. And even if I didn't understand what those mean, because God gave those as reason, that tells me I need to be holy. Make sense? All right, let's go to chapter 22. What's it about? Eating food for priests. And so let's go to question number four. What were the requirements for the acceptable sacrifice? That comes later, beginning at verse 17. Let's go ahead and get that. What were the requirements for acceptable sacrifice? What was it? Without blemish. Be the right age. It was to be of their own. And if they were eating it, it was to be eaten the same day. All right, we'll get to that in a moment. Talk about eating holy food. Verses 1 to 16. This again deals, as Stephen mentioned a moment ago, it bleeds over from chapter 21. This is more regulations for the priest. And so you speak to Aaron and his sons, that they, the New King James uses the word separate themselves from the holy things. That wording is a little obscure to me, that you would think you go toward holy things, but it's saying you abstain. It's the idea, the English Standard uses the word abstain. They are to abstain from eating food that the priest should eat under certain circumstances. The reason for that is, look at verse 2, at the end of verse 2, because I am the Lord. Now, the priest cannot eat when he is unclean. Yeah. Look at verse 3, in his uncleanness. So the one who eats in the uncleanness will be cut off from my presence. It's a little different phrase than we have seen in some of the other cutoff statements. That may mean death, which I think it probably means. Some think it means he will never serve in the priesthood again. Of course, if death is the case, he won't serve again either. So it could be both, I suppose. I don't mean to make fun of that or light of that, but it's just simply, I think it probably means death. At verse 4, if he's a leper or if he has a discharge, or has an emission, any of that takes place, he's not to eat. Whoever teaches a creeping thing, he's unclean. And I'm hurrying through this, not because it's unimportant. I want to get to some other things in chapters 23 and 24 in a moment. that whatever dies naturally or torn by a beast, he's not to eat. That would suggest it's not been properly bled. And again, the reason, I am the Lord. And so you'll keep this ordinance, and I, the Lord, sanctify them. So again, the emphasis here is on the priest and the high priest being holy and pure. It's a holy priesthood. Is that making sense? This is a holy priesthood. It's what we're supposed to be. Now, verses 10 to 16, what do we learn? No stranger, no outsider that sojourns with you. In other words, there would be outsiders come. There'd be people traveling through. There was a mixed multitude that went along with them that are not Israelites. They're not to eat of the holy things. Unless, verse 11, priest buys him, he'd be a slave. And so if a priest has bought him, then he's basically part of his household. Or if he's born into the house of the priest, he could eat of that. If the married daughter marries an outsider, what about that? Can't eat of that. But if the priest's daughter is divorced or is a widow and doesn't have a child and she returns back to her father's house, she may eat. But no outsider shall eat. Now then, verse 14 and 15 and 16 seem to shift gears a little bit. It's still part of this, no outsider can eat. What's 14, 15, and 16 saying? Yeah, this seems to be a transgress offering for the sin with reference to these holy things that the outsider and so forth should not eat. That if a man eats a holy thing unintentionally, then he is to restore that. According to verse 14, and add a fifth, 20%, but they shall not profane the holy things. And so there's to be an offering that was to be made for them, that a holy offering, take a holy offering to the priest, and so he restores it, makes an offering, etc. That's the point to be made. So that could be done accidentally at times. Let's move on to 17 to 20. We've already answered the question. So let's see what these sacrifices, what's the overall lesson that we learn as we back away? We'll come to the specifics in a moment. So I'm not talking about the details, but just a one or two word summary of 17 to 31. What did you learn from that? God wanted the best. God wanted the best. That gives emphasis again to the holy sacrifice, the holy priesthood, the holy service, purity of service. It gives us the idea of the best. So let's scan through this before we get into chapter 23. We're just going to hit this quickly because this is somewhat of a summary of this offerings of what chapters? Chapters 1 through 7, yes. All right, it's to be without blemish. We see that in 17 to 25. And it's to be a free will offering. We'll see more about that at verse 29, but that's implied at verse 18. But verse 19 said it's to be a male from the cattle or from the sheep or from the goats and without blemish. God wants the best. Notice God specifies that it's not to be, verse 22, the blind and the broken and those with scabs and those with skin conditions and those with ulcers. What does that tell you? I'm talking about in general terms about service to God. Do you think we ever bring we don't sacrifice literal lambs, but do you think we ever bring any blind lambs to the Lord? Any lame lambs? Some are maimed or with ulcers. You know he's going to die anyway, not going to make it, and I need to sacrifice something, so I'll sacrifice him and keep the better for myself. Do we do that with our time? Do we do that with our schedules? Do we do that with our money? Good point. Our worship? Yeah, we bring the blind and the lame and the sick. All right, God's not going to accept all of that. Now, notice at verse 26 to 28, the right age. What was the right age? The animal needs to be at least, 8 days old. For the first 7 days, it stays with its mother, but on the 8th day, he could be accepted, but you're not to kill the mother and the offspring the same day. And so there were certain regulations. Verse 29, to be of the own free will, to be eaten the same day. And now let's summarize verses 31 to 35. You see this several times where he mentions, at verse 30, I am the Lord. I am the Lord, verse 31. I am the Lord who sanctifies him, verse 32, and I am the Lord. But the emphasis of 31 to 33 is, I want them to be holy. So chapters 21 and 22 kind of go together as companion chapters. God wanted the priesthood to be holy in what he was doing and in his own conduct. Does that make sense? I want you to be holy in your actions, chapter 22, in your own conduct, chapter 21. God wants us to do the same thing. Does that have any application to us? Well, sure. When we come to offer worship, God wants us to be holy in what we're doing, but God wants the person offering it to be holy. And so if I'm ungodly and I come and do godly things, it's not going to be any good. And vice versa. All right, let's go to chapter 23 now. We've got some ground to cover. Let's see what we can find in chapter 23. We label this just as feast. And the chapter, if you're reading from one of the translations, it breaks it down by sections. You probably are broken down in these seven sections here. You have the Sabbath, you have the Passover of an unleavened bread, you have the Feast of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of the Tabernacles. A lot of stuff there. I want to break them up just a little bit. Now, we'll start with the Sabbath. That was something that happened every week. But the next three sections, the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and the Feast of the First Fruits, and the Feast of Weeks, were the early, in their calendar year, were their early feast at the beginning of the harvest. Make sense? Then these other three were their latter feast in the seventh month at the end of their harvest. Now, you're going to see this slide again. So I'm not done. I'm coming back if you're trying to write any of that down. So what we're talking about is there's other information on this calendar. And so I remind you, the outer circle is our calendar. The inner circle is their Jewish calendar. And their Jewish calendar started right here. And so you have the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Pentecost. And we're going to add one they didn't have. They're the Feast of Harvest. And those were the early feasts. Everything else mentioned in our chapter is over here in the seventh month, right here. It all piled together over there. Make sense? Early feast and late feast. Beginning of the harvest, the end of the harvest. So we got a lot to cover in chapter 23. We're going to have to cover it quickly. Let's see what we can do. Well, I didn't mean to go that quick. Let's go back to chapter 23. Verses 1 to 3 deals with the... Particularly verse 3, 6 days shall work be done, but they'll rest on the Sabbath. That's pretty simple, so we're going to move on. There's the Passover and the unleavened bread. The Passover took place on the first month, on the 14th day of the month, and that was the Passover. They're commemorating the deliverance from Egypt. And then on the 15th day, the very next day, starts the seven-day feast of unleavened bread. And there was to be a holy convocation. What's a convocation? First, something we talk about all the time. We just don't use the word convocation. A gathering, an assembly. It's going to be a holy assembly is what that means. And so you might put that in the margin of your text in case you don't remember that the next time you read that. But that took place. And so we'll try to go back to the calendar each time. They have the Passover. That was right here, the Passover that you see takes place. And immediately following that, that's about the first part of our April, and there is this Feast of Unleavened Bread. So they have no leaven in the house for 7 days. So at the beginning of that, they have a holy convocation. At the end of that, they have a holy assembly. And so all of this is marking and celebrating in the next couple of feasts the beginning of their harvest period. All right, the next thing that he mentions, beginning at verse 9 through verse 14, is the Feast of the First Fruits. Not to be confused with the Feast of Weeks, which is also a Feast of First Fruits. So what's the difference? Well, Exodus 23 talks about this a little bit, if you want to flag that, but this seems to be the first fruits of the barley harvest. And there's a wave and a sheave offering. That's where we get the idea that it's barley. And this again is marking and celebrating the beginning of God's blessings of their harvest period. Making sense? And so it fits in right here where we slipped that in just a minute ago. We just added it right there. It was kind of a floating time in the sense that there was not a specific day, the 14th day of a certain month, that it began. But it would begin before Pentecost. Does that make sense? Because within 50 days then, as we have here at verse 16, there would be this Feast of Weeks, also referred to as Pentecost. Now, this was the feast of, this was, again, marks the beginning of their feast. And this was the feast of the first fruits of their wheat harvest were celebrated and sacrificed and given to the Lord. Now, a couple of things we want to flag before we leave that section. Verse 18 mentions they're to bring one bull and two rams. When we get over to Numbers, and this is mentioned again, that's reversed. Two bulls and one ram. Why the difference? Willis suggests that it's probably a copyist error, but in which one, we don't know. That one of these may be, and so that's not a big deal. It's not, we're not offering it, so we don't have to know which one it was. But they had three animals to offer, which was the two and which was the one. You pick either text or harmonize them in some other way. Then notice at verse 22, God had a provision when they start bringing in their harvest. What was the provision at verse 22? Yeah, take care of the poor and leave the corners for the poor. All right, now then we're ready for the latter feast. So let's go to the Feast of Trumpets, then we'll see the Day of Atonement and the Feast of the Tabernacles. We've got them all right here. The Feast of the Trumpets that is mentioned next, also referred to as the Day of Jubilation, chapter 29 of Numbers, that marked the end of the summer and harvest. We had celebration of the beginning, now these are the latter feast. So this is the celebration of the end. And it was a memorial, according to verse 25. Then there was the Day of Atonement. You might flag Leviticus 16. We are not going to say much about that because we've dealt with that already. And then there's the Feast of the Tabernacles for 7 days. And that took place right at the end. That was the last one they had on the calendar. This is where they dwelled in booths. That was the thing that when we come to the day of Nehemiah, they had neglected, and they suddenly read the text and discover, hey, we hadn't been doing that. That's this very feast right here. It was a commemoration of remembrance. This was to be done after the entering of the land of their journey and travelings through the wilderness. So God had ways of reminding them of all of that. All right, now let's go on to in the last 5 minutes and talk about chapter 24. There's the care of the tabernacle and the furnishings and the blasphemy. I want us to get to the blasphemy if we can, quickly as we can. But I want you to notice the emphasis on purity in this chapter. Holiness, purity this time. You might underline it, verse 2, they were to bring their pure oil. Did you notice that? And it was to be put on a table made of, or the lampstand, it was to be used in the lampstand that was made of, verse 4, pure gold. God seems to be giving emphasis to purity. So when you take care of this, you make sure you've got a pure gold for the lampstand, and you make sure you've got pure oil. The best purity, holiness is being emphasized. But we're not through. Let's go to the bread, verses 5 to 9. We've talked about the 12 cakes of bread. They were sizable. They were heavy. When we look at the amount of what went into those bread. But notice that they are to set on a pure table, verse 6, and there is to be pure frankincense, verse 7. Seems to be an emphasis on purity. When a text repeats a word multiple times, it usually gives you some indication of what God's wanting you to see there. So purity is emphasized time and again. Now, right in the middle of giving all these instructions, seemingly interrupting the whole storyline, because we come back to things in chapter 25, here's a case of blasphemy. And so you have a case where an Israelite woman married an Egyptian man and her son blasphemed the name of God. He was brought to Moses, flag now verse 12, and he put him in custody that the mind of the Lord might be shown to them. Moses was not going to act until God revealed what he wanted him to do. Isn't that interesting? We're going to hold him here till God tells us what we're to do with him. And that shows the mind of the Lord. So what did the Lord tell him to do? Stone him. He's to be put to death. And so I want to go back to verse 12. Moses was not going to act until, let's get the wording here, the mind of the Lord might be shown to them. When God said, here's what I want you to do, the mind of the Lord had been shown to them. When the execution takes place, the punishment takes place, that also showed the mind of the Lord to them. The Lord didn't want that blasphemy. The Lord's not going to tolerate that blasphemy. The Lord wants holiness and purity. Does that make sense? There's a double take, I think, on verse 12 that we just gave. Now, at verse 17, he adds to that, whoever kills a man shall surely be put to death, but whoever kills an animal shall make good animal for animal. I just learned something powerful there about animal rights. They don't have them. Did you see that? They don't have them. But here's what I learned from that. Animal life is not the same as human life. And if you follow the left thinking of our society and go the direction of the left, you come to the conclusion animal life and human life are the same. In fact, animal life may be more valuable than human life. You can take a baby's life even after it comes out of the womb, but you kill a dog and you may go to jail for that. God thought an animal life was different than human life. You're to be executed if a human is killed, but if you kill an animal, you need to make it good, but you're not going to die. They must not be the same. Now let's quickly get 19 and 20, and we're going to be done. I know I haven't stopped for questions or practical lessons, but we're going to have to be done here pretty quick. This idea of if a man is disfigured, if disfigures his neighbor, etc., it shall be done to him as was he did to his neighbor. Fracture for fracture, eye for an eye, and tooth for a tooth. That's quoted or referenced in Matthew 5. This is not personal retaliation. That was to be executed by the priest or the judges. Does that make sense? That was not, all right, your neighbor comes and knocks your eye out, you go over and knock his eye out. That's personal retaliation. Even in the Old Testament, that was never encouraged. But there was, even in execution, somebody killed some member of your family, you don't go track them down, but that was there were channels to go through. But it's the idea of an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. That is, justice ought to be administered. All right, we're going to have to be done as far as that. We got about 30 seconds to go. Anybody have a practical lesson you want to mention here? Absolutely. Capital punishment is different from murder. So when the state executes a man or woman, that's not murder. Good point. What else? One more. All right, very good. We'll stop right there.